KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. The federal moratorium on evictions is set to expire today, even as the White House urges Congress to pass legislation so the eviction ban could be further extended. Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to lift an eviction ban for tenants who did not pay all or some of their rent during the pandemic. New Mexico is one of a handful of states that will still protect renters, but they must file some paperwork. Here's Roz Brown from the New Mexico News Connection.
Bree Sillery with the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness says it's a good thing there's no immediate change in the state because most homeless shelters are at capacity.
We are operating with a homeless response system already inundated. And because of the financial implications of the pandemic, we have seen an increase in people that are living on the street.
The pandemic caused many to lose their jobs and fall behind on rent and utility payments. Sillery estimates 60 to 80,000 New Mexico households would be facing eviction without the state and local moratoriums. Renters or landlords facing financial difficulties can find help through renthelpnm.org, but must apply by August 30th. Sillery says New Mexico has about $150 million available in federal aid for rent and utility assistance to households experiencing financial hardship due to COVID-19.
What we want to do now is ensure that as New Mexicans are seeing these federal moratoriums come to an end, that both tenants and landlords know that they are still protected.
In a 5-4 ruling last month, the U.S. Supreme Court left the federal ban on evictions in place. But the Biden administration said Wednesday it lacks the authority to require the CDC to extend the moratorium past this weekend and called on Congress to pass legislation to do so. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And as we have been telling you, the New Mexico Supreme Court has already halted evictions for those impacted by the pandemic in the state. But some remain concerned renters do not have enough protections. Maria Griego is an attorney who specializes in housing issues as economic equity director for the New Mexico Center on Law and Poverty. She talked with Anthony Moreno.
Right now, the New Mexico stay is still in place. We know that the Supreme Court is planning a phase-out approach to lifting that stay, but we don't know when it will happen yet. So the good news is even with the federal moratorium ending at the end of the month, we still do have the state stay in place. That aside, we do know that there have been several judges who have been reluctant anyway to grant the protections of the federal stay, which we think is wrong. So the federal moratorium only applies in states where the protections aren't as great. So it was really designed to sort of pick up the slack where states had not provided great protections. What we believe at the center is that actually neither is greater, that they both should apply in New Mexico because they have different protections and neither protection is necessarily greater than the other. It just sort of depends on the renter's individual circumstances. But we do know that some judges have just taken the approach that the federal moratorium doesn't apply. And so, you know, for some courtrooms, it's not going to matter because the judges haven't been granting those protections anyway, and have only been granting the protections under the New Mexico Supreme Court stay.
In New Mexico, how fast can the eviction process legally happen?
So it's very fast in New Mexico. We have some of the shortest timelines in the country, specifically about non-payment of rent. So, if your rent is due on the first of the month and you don't pay it on the first, the next day the landlord can give you a 3-day notice of non-payment of rent, which essentially says you have 3 days to pay or I can file for eviction. And if you don't pay within those 3 days, the landlord can go file. Your hearing happens in under 2 weeks. I hate to use this term, but essentially it's like a factory, right? Like it's not an in-depth evidentiary hearing. The judges just want very quick, short answers to their questions. They issue a ruling, and then, within days, the sheriff can be at your door evicting you.
You recently wrote a guest column for the Albuquerque Journal calling for landlord-tenant collaboration. How do you think this can happen. I mean, why should landlords want to collaborate with tenants in a time when we are seeing rising housing costs and prices going up all around us?
You know, right now, a lot of folks have a short-sighted approach of, you know, what's happening trying to capitalize on this housing market. But we have to be thinking long-term, because New Mexico has been in a housing crisis long before COVID ever came. And, you know, COVID has sort of really laid bare what the problems are with our housing system and exacerbated already really bad problems. And so, yes, in the short term, it might make a lot of sense to, you know, get a couple thousand dollars, you know, on a sale. But long term, you know, if we're looking beyond our own self-interest and looking at the needs and the interests of the state as a whole, we've really got to come up with some solutions for how to make housing better in New Mexico.
Okay, Maria, thank you so much for your time.
Sure. Thank you for reaching out.
A bill to add more protections for renters in New Mexico stalled in the legislative session. House Bill 111 was co-sponsored by Las Cruces State Representative Angelica Rubio. She talked with Anthony Moreno about how the bill would aim to provide more housing protections for renters.
So House Bill 111 was a piece of legislation we introduced this past session. It was myself and Representative Romero from Santa Fe. And it was working to increase rental protections during emergencies, but we were also including provisions not related to the pandemic, but more so in terms of extending the time permitted to pay unpaid rent, requiring longer time periods for non-payment, things like that, things that have really been detrimental to landlord and tenants in the past. And we finally got to a place where everybody could agree on, pass the House and then guide in Senate Judiciary. It never got a hearing. And so we right now are actively working to see if this is an issue that we can bring back up in the January session. This issue would have to be on the call. The governor would have to put it on the agenda. And she didn't put it on the agenda last June during our special session. It's unclear on whether or not it will be done so in 2022. Regardless, this is an issue that we're working on with other state agencies who actually have the ability to make some administrative support to help with tenants and landlords.
Democratic State Representative Angelica Rubio, thanks for your time.
Awesome. Thank you.
Turning to city politics now, and downtown Las Cruces is getting new projects worth an estimated $1.8 million. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Over $1.8 million is being allocated by the Las Cruces Tax Increment Development District Board for downtown projects, including funding for the Amador Hotel restoration and a redesign of Combo Street. The amount of TID funding available at the start of fiscal year 2022 is estimated to be more than $5.3 million, though some of the funding is restricted to specific uses, such as street projects. From that fund, $1.5 million is being allocated for the Amador Hotel restoration. Jennifer Morrow, the city's engineering administrator, says now that a historic evaluation report has been completed, the next step is conducting a structural report on the property.
For us to do those structural reports, we need to have about 1.5 to 2 million, and that is why we are here before the board, because that is what we're looking for, is money for us to be able to get those reports completed and then to move on to the construction phasing.
According to the TID resolution, the entire Amador Hotel restoration is estimated to cost $9 million. Over $200,000 in grants and donations, as well as over $777,000 in legislative capital outlay funding, has already been received. Sonia Cooper, a member of the Amador Hotel Foundation board, says additional funding could come from being designated a National Historic Landmark.
Once we get the designation of a National Historic Landmark, that then opens up the funding at the state level, at the national level, and through a lot of organizations, professional and private and government organizations.
Councilor Tessa Beda-Stuvey indicated her full support for the Amador Hotel project, noting that an investment needs to be made to ensure safety.
My main concern is making sure that at least the exterior of the building is safe, and also appealing as much work as we're doing in the downtown. We want to make sure that we're not subtracting any of that aesthetic value.
Councilor Gil Sorg also voiced his support, noting the historic nature of the Amador property.
So I'm thinking in my mind, this could even possibly be a national monument. I wouldn't rule it out. So we get it all fixed up, maybe we'll go for that too. If we need more money, I would say I'm in favor of having it taken out of the TID.
Other TID projects include a $200,000 redesign of Combo Street, a design process expected to take between 6 and 8 months. $45,000 is also being set aside to install data tracking signs to help gather information on pedestrian traffic. An additional $50,000 will go towards sound equipment for arts and cultural events. The Renovate Main Street program, which matches money for business improvement, is set to receive $50,000. Councillor Ioana Bencomo advocated for additional funding to be added to the program.
$50,000 to me doesn't feel like enough, and I feel like if we're going to make an investment in downtown, that's what it looks like, especially for people who are excited to open up the kind of businesses that we would like to see.
Funding to install shade structures within the Plaza de las Cruces was the only proposed TID project not approved by the board, originally estimated to cost around $993,000. The required budget to complete the project is now approximately $1.3 million. Public Works Director David Cedillo says the increase can be attributed to a rise in cost for both labor and materials.
This is a steel structure, so yes, those prices have increased. That's why we're seeing that difference, because we're going and getting those estimates now.
While Councillor Cassandra Gondra ultimately voted with the rest of the board to delay funding, she stressed it's still a priority.
I'm anxious to get it up. I think there are folks that feel very strongly that this needs to get to get up. I mean, I've been on council 6 years, so I think it's I'm advocating for it to be up. But if I hear, you know, a strong let's wait and see what the market looks like, I'm also willing to hear that for sure.
The $1.3 million is money Councillor Ioana Bencomo says could be better invested in other areas, highlighting economic challenges that have resulted from the COVID-19 pandemic.
I may be in the minority on the council, but to me, a small business incubator feels significantly important right now as we enter this sort of post-pandemic world. As, you know, businesses begin to recover, as people who perhaps started home-based built businesses in the last year and a half, that to me seems incredibly important.
The city is currently exploring the legality of dedicating TID money to a business incubator. More information on the incubator is expected to be presented to the council at the next TID meeting in October. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Border News Now, and a Border Patrol spokesperson says the agency will install rescue beacons across the Big Bend region to make it easier for migrants in distress to call for help. Marfa Public Radio's Annie Rosenthal has more.
The Greater Big Bend region is made up of vast stretches of desert terrain, and it generally sees far fewer migrant crossings than other parts of the border. But in recent months, Border Patrol apprehensions in the region have increased, and so have the number of migrant deaths. Border Patrol's Big Bend Sector Chief, Sean McGoffin, says the region has seen 32 deaths since October, which is more than four times as many as it recorded in all of last year.
They're not prepared for these distances. They're not prepared for the terrain and the difficulties, because we have mountains and canyons. And there's not a lot of water, just not a lot of water at all. There's no place for them to water up a lot of times.
McGoffin says Border Patrol plans to deploy 30 new rescue beacons across the region to help agents locate migrants in distress. Each beacon is 30 feet tall with a blue strobe light on top and a button to call for help. Now, the agency is working on getting permission from ranchers and other private landowners to place the beacons in heavily trafficked areas. I'm Annie Rosenthal in Marfa.
More than 200 people have arrived in the United States on the first evacuation flight for Afghans who worked alongside Americans in Afghanistan. The airliner carrying the interpreters and their family members landed Friday in Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C. The flights are dubbed Operation Allies Refuge and are intended to bring to the U.S. Afghans who are farthest along in their visa process. The interpreters, translators, and others fear reprisals from Afghanistan's Taliban as the last U.S. troops leave. President Joe Biden says he is proud to tell the newly arrived Afghans, welcome home. A refugee agency urges Biden to bring more of the Afghans quickly to the U.S. As the military completes its withdrawal from Afghanistan, many interpreters and others who worked alongside Allied forces are left behind, despite being eligible for special visas. Houston has resettled some 1,700 of these Afghans and their families. Thousands more are still in Afghanistan. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval sat down for tea with some of them in Southwest Houston.
Umid Ahmadyar.
Nice to meet you.
Umid Elahi.
Nice to meet you.
At his apartment, Halil Arab introduces me to six of his friends. All are Afghan immigrants. We sit on the carpeted tan floor in the living room. Arab pours hot green and black tea into assorted mugs.
Anyone wants green tea for a change?
All have moved to Houston from Afghanistan in the last 7 years. Most worked as interpreters for Americans or allied forces during the last 2 decades of armed conflict in their country. That work qualified them for a special immigrant visa, or SIV. Here's Mohammed Issa Qadri.
I am originally from Kapisa province of Afghanistan, which is not safe for interpreters. And I live in Afghanistan. I was working with the U.S. Special Forces. And it took about almost 4 years to get my visa.
The tedious visa process has caused delays for thousands of Afghan interpreters and other workers. These delays threaten their lives even more as the Taliban retakes territory in Afghanistan. Qadri says he has a few close friends struggling to get visas.
We apply at the same time. It's been like 2 years that I'm here. They're still waiting on their approval. We applied the same day.
Qadri says they're desperate to get out.
I know one of my friends. He's stuck in the middle of Taliban right now in Kunar province. And like 2 days ago, I talked to him. He said, I cannot escape anywhere. I'm stuck. I'm hide in my house. I cannot go nowhere.
Evacuation efforts are underway for qualifying Afghan allies with pending visas, though some interpreters are skeptical, as the visa process has been riddled with complications and unfulfilled promises. Qadri says these people deserve to be safe in the U.S.
I hope all my friends should be here because they deserve it. They work with me like we were shoulder by shoulder sitting to each other and talking.
These men have formed a new community in Houston, but they're frequently reminded of danger back home. They're contacted by former coworkers, friends, family, asking for help on how to get visas. Halil Arab says an old colleague wants to flee the country, but doesn't know where to start.
I'm very concerned for him, but at the same time, there's not really much I can do. And his son is reaching out every day, you know, asking questions.
Beyond processing delays, there are other fundamental barriers to this visa program, says interpreter Saeed Omid Akhmadir. There are many others, plumbers, guards, cooks, who worked for allied forces and don't have access to even apply for a visa.
And there are, I guess there are a lot of people, they do not have an email account, email ID, or they do not have Facebook, or they cannot speak English, and they worked with coalition forces or American people, and they are left behind. I'm worried about those people.
On the other hand, interpreters tell me the Taliban doesn't discriminate. Cooks or others who work with the U.S. military are perceived as traitors, just like interpreters in combat. The Taliban has a reputation for hunting down and killing people associated with allied forces. Here's Abdul Rasul Tahiri.
I'm telling honestly, the Taliban, they don't know about the humanity. Only they kill anyone. Only work with U.S. people. That's not a matter 1 day or 2 days or 2 years.
As we sip our tea, these men say they hope the Taliban won't regain its control of the country, but acknowledge it's likely. They say it's even more critical that their friends are evacuated as soon as possible. I'm Elizabeth Troval in Houston.
Well, listen to this. A report by the bipartisan think tank New American Economy finds North Texas is the fastest growing metro area for immigrants. As KERA's Stella Chavez reports, more than 48,000 new immigrants moved to the Dallas-Fort Worth area in just 1 year.
The report uses data from the U.S. Census Bureau's 2019 American Community Survey. It was released as part of a new interactive map by the group New American Economy that shows the economic contributions of immigrants in the country's 100 largest metro areas. Jeremy Robbins is the group's executive director. He says the influx of immigrants is a boon for North Texas.
It's a good sign because it means there's opportunity there. And it's a good sign because when people come, they create opportunity, right? They start businesses, they spend money, they buy homes, they do things that generate growth.
Robbins says this trend is particularly important as the nation recovers from a recession and the pandemic's economic shock. He says the communities that recovered the strongest and fastest after the 2008 financial crisis were the ones that could fill available jobs.
Those jobs that are associated with growth, right? You want entrepreneurs, you want people to be able to make your construction boom happen so that the other industries that depend on construction can go back. You want tourism and hospitality so you can bring people into your community.
The data show immigrants are disproportionately represented in industries like construction. Also worth noting, Robbins says, immigrants who've moved to North Texas are 25% more likely than native-born residents to start a business. I'm Stella Chavez in Dallas.
Now some border news that is also environmental news. To create a route for the southern border wall, the Trump administration used blasting techniques typically reserved for mining operations. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown reports.
A newly released map identifies portions of the U.S.-Mexico border wall built by the Trump administration. And for conservation groups and wildlife advocates, it's alarming. The Biden administration halted construction and said it will use federal funds to assess damage caused by the new higher walls. Map creator Miles Traphagen with the nonprofit Wildlands Network says in addition to environmental damage, the project identified several areas in border states where restoration to benefit wildlife is needed.
There's very high biodiversity in southeastern Arizona, southwestern New Mexico. It's a meeting ground of the neotropics and the temperate zones. It's the only place where the jaguar and the black bear share the same trail.
Upon halting border wall construction, the Biden administration said it plans to perform environmental assessments, which had been waived by Trump to speed construction. Michael Dax with the Wildlands Network says the map may surprise some who don't realize the extent of wall that was built in 3 years or how much of North America has been walled off from Mexico.
The Trump administration was sadly very successful in building significant portions of wall. It has been hugely impactful to wildlife. There are numerous pictures of wildlife that are dead along the wall, not able to reach historic water sources.
Traphagen says some border landscapes in New Mexico have been permanently altered, including one area where a high-speed road was built and stadium lighting installed.
And now there's no ability for pronghorn, antelope, and coyotes and all the other creatures to move freely across the landscape that they've inhabited for tens of thousands of years.
Biden's executive order paused all new border wall construction, and Traphagen says contractors soon abandoned the sites.
They just were throwing it up as fast as they possibly could, and the construction companies basically got up and left. There's just debris littering the entire border.
This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
To commentary now, and a New Mexico case has raised an important question. A lot of people talking about this. Should churches take actions against legislators based on their voting records? Some thoughts on this from commentator Walt Rubel.
In 2019, the New Mexico Senate rejected a bill that would have removed an old, invalid abortion law from the books. 1 year later, voters had their say. Six Democratic senators who voted against the bill were removed from office, including powerful veterans such as President Pro Tem Mary Kay Papin and Finance Committee Chairman John Arthur Smith. Clearly, the bill was supported not only by Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham and the House, but also by a majority of voters in New Mexico. But it passed against the wishes of the Catholic Church, which has now tried to strike back. Senator Joseph Cervantes, who voted for the bill and retained his Senate seat, announced last week that some new clergy within the Las Cruces Catholic Diocese has decided that his vote disqualifies him from being able to take communion. It's a tactic Catholic leaders have used many times before, with little success. President Joe Biden recently was denied communion at a Catholic church in South Carolina. Presidential candidate John Kerry was denied communion at a Catholic church in Boston during the heat of a presidential race. New York Governor Mario Cuomo, former California Governor Gray Davis, former Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius, U.S. Representative Patrick Kennedy, and even former Republican presidential candidate Rudy Giuliani have all been denied communion based on their views on abortion. That may have caused personal pain for the individuals involved, but not one person changed his or her position as a result. Christopher Velasquez, a spokesman for the Catholic Diocese of Las Cruces, defended the decision by explaining to the Sun News that Cervantes had been told multiple times by the church how he should vote on that bill, yet he went against their orders. When John F. Kennedy ran for president in 1960, there was great concern among millions of Americans that if he won, the nation's leader would be subservient to the Pope. Kennedy's independence and his willingness to put the interests of the nation above the teachings of his church opened the door for the many Catholics who have followed him into public office, including our current president. I realize that I'm making a political argument and not a moral one, but that's because of the total insignificance of the bill that's causing all the ruckus. Passage of Senate Bill 10 had no impact on the lives of New Mexico residents. It removed a law that's been unconstitutional and thus unenforceable since the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision of 1973. Should that ruling ever be reversed, the current legislature at that time should decide how to proceed, not the one that was elected in the 1950s. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. For more local viewpoints, check out krwg.org. You'll find a diverse set of columns in the local viewpoint section right under the news tab. Well, most Democratic Texas House members flew to Washington, D.C., breaking quorum to prevent a vote on election legislation they call voter suppression. Republicans want to end some voting changes implemented last year that coincided with a big increase in turnout. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider spoke with Harris County voters who use the methods Republicans are now trying to ban.
Last year, Harris County introduced an array of voting innovations to make it easier and safer to vote during the presidential elections. They included drive-through voting, expanded voting hours with one day of 24-hour voting, and sending out mail-in ballot applications to all eligible voters. Joy Davis is a stay-at-home mom. She voted in a drive-through location on the east side of Houston.
Oh, it was amazing. It was so convenient. I felt safe because it was at the highlight of the pandemic before I was able to get any vaccinations.
Almost immediately, Republicans sued to block the innovations. One suit would have thrown out roughly 127,000 ballots cast at drive-through locations.
And it was horrifying. It felt as if I was going to be disenfranchised as a voter.
That suit ultimately failed, though one banning the mass mailing of mail-in ballot applications succeeded. In the end, Harris County had its highest voter turnout rate in almost 30 years. The county has been trending Democratic, but for the most part, local Republicans held their seats. Donald Trump carried Texas by fewer than 6 points. Republicans soon responded with proposals to change the state's election laws. The alleged reason was to prevent fraud, even though Governor Greg Abbott, who called for the legislation, admitted he knew of no significant fraud in 2020. Jason Oliver used a drive-through voting site at the Toyota Center in downtown Houston.
So it definitely seems directed at Harris County's efforts to expand opportunities for people to vote, shutting down or reducing people's access to the mail-in ballots, reducing access to drive-through voting.
And banning 24-hour voting. James Lamas participated in a 30-person midnight bike ride from Midtown Houston to NRG Park on the city's south side. He voted around 1 a.m., not because he had to, but because he wanted to support shift workers who couldn't vote during regular daytime hours.
I mean, I don't see any legitimate security concern with letting people vote at one hour versus another. I mean, it was the same process, same protocols at the polling location at midnight as there would be at noon.
Texas House Democrats have broken quorum twice in order to prevent passage of voting restrictions, once at the end of the regular legislative session and now in the special session. Maria Benzon, an assistant principal who used drive-through voting in Bel Air, says she's proud of those lawmakers.
Sometimes you need to shake up the system for people to be made aware of what's going on. And what's going on in our state, what the governor is trying to do, it's so wrong.
Governor Abbott and House Speaker Dade Phelan are demanding Democratic lawmakers return from Washington, D.C. to do their jobs. But hospital worker Silenthia Horde, who used drive-through voting at Houston's NRG Park, says that's just what they're doing by staying away.
You represent the people. You do what the people want you to do. And in their districts, we don't want this.
Still, it's uncertain how long Democratic lawmakers can sustain their walkout. Governor Abbott says he'll continue to call one special session after another until the voting legislation is passed. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. The Las Cruces City Council this week reviewed staff recommendations for cannabis regulation. Madison Staten has our report.
The Las Cruces City Council is working to shape cannabis policy on the local level, reviewing time, place, and manner recommendations during a recent work session. Policy considerations include limiting consumption areas to indoors and establishing buffer zones between businesses. That buffer zone, a proposed 1,000 feet, has been a matter of concern for some members of the public, with cannabis industry stakeholders advocating for a reduction in the required distance of businesses at a recent cannabis town hall. Las Cruces resident Xavier Hall, who works in the cannabis industry, spoke out against the recommended distance at the work session, saying those in the cannabis industry face significant challenges when attempting to secure a space for their business.
That only adds to kind of a hard problem that we have. So working for Pure Life, I've been recently, over the last year and a half, looking for a new location for us because we've outgrown the location that we're at right now. What I've run into is that, yes, you think facilities are open, but property owners don't want you. They don't want you there.
Catherine Harrison Rogers with the city's Community Development Department says the city has heard from many residents who oppose some of the recommendations.
We've received a lot of feedback on these about perhaps that those might be an overreach in terms of the part of the city, since we don't require that for either bars or pharmacies or other like uses. At this point in time, the way we have written the language, we do have some due process available if people in those industries did want to be closer to those residential zones or from another cannabis retailer.
Councilor Ioana Bencomo advocated for the reduction, asking that the proposed distance be changed to 600 feet, a statewide recommendation from the New Mexico Cannabis Chamber of Commerce.
How do we try to destigmatize this as much as possible? I would personally be comfortable and supportive of going down to 600 and take the recommendation of the industry.
Under the proposed policy, cannabis businesses will be required to keep a 300-foot distance from single-family residential zones. Councillor Tessa Beda-Stuvi says she feels comfortable with staff recommendations. She also recommended that businesses be required to install both cameras and lights to establish clear sight pathways around the establishments.
I do think at least cameras and lights, especially very clearly marked at the entrance and exits as people are pulling out, I think they need to be able to have like really clear views. We do have some properties. I know I have one at the corner of University and El Paseo where there's trees that are meant as, you know, just decorative, but they do pose a bit of a hazard when it comes to pulling out of those areas.
Las Cruces Assistant City Manager Ikani Taumoy-Piao says the state is already working to ensure security measures are put in place.
They will be looking at lighting, cameras, ensuring that there's security, proper security with a security guard. That is one thing that is being taken care of. We're working with the state as well so that we can review those plans. One of the things that we can look into and we can get information is the type of speeds, you know, we can get with public work and see these areas along the commercial sites that might be perfect spots for dispensary locations. We can look into those and, you know, do an assessment and see where we're at right now and present that at a later date.
Members of the public interested in providing additional feedback on city cannabis policy can do so through the City of Las Cruces Cannabis Survey online. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Health news now, and new evidence showing the Delta variant is as contagious as chickenpox has prompted U.S. health officials to consider changing advice on how the nation fights the coronavirus. Recommending masks for everyone and requiring vaccines for doctors and other healthcare providers are among the measures the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is considering. That's according to internal documents obtained by the Washington Post. The presentation for CDC staff tells them to, quote, acknowledge the war has changed. It notes infections in vaccinated people may be as transmissible as in the unvaccinated. That is why, starting on Monday at the recommendation of New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, masks will be required indoors when social distancing is not possible in the entire New Mexico State University system, including community colleges. This is something we're seeing in many institutions, not only in New Mexico, but across the nation. As the pandemic took hold in April 2020, Dr. Heather Jarrell stepped into a new role, New Mexico Chief Medical Examiner. KUNM's Megan Kamrick talked with Jarrell about how the pandemic affected her office and staff, especially with the ongoing shortage of forensic pathologists here and around the country.
At one point, I believe there were up to 10 refrigerator trucks outside your offices on the UNM campus. What was that like coming into work every day and seeing that?
It's a bit daunting, and I think it really, I remember seeing some posts that people not affiliated with the OMI had posted. People would show me a post that they had seen on social media that, oh my goodness, there's refrigerated trucks at the OMI, and really kind of hitting home with those people who had posted that. And they actually use that to market the importance of getting vaccinated. And so at least they were using that in a positive way to encourage people to get vaccinated.
The Office of the Medical Investigator routinely sees traumatic deaths. How was COVID different? Was it very different for you and your staff?
There wasn't a lot known about the virus when it really started hitting New Mexico and the rest of the country as well. We were cautious. We exercised all of our normal precautions. And it was a little, I would say that it's always present in the back of your mind. And, you know, oh my gosh, I took my hood off. But when I took my hood off, did that part of my hood brush against my face? Did I take my PPE off appropriately? Because we all know that's the time when we, as medical examiners and autopsy technicians and so on, are most at risk when we're removing it. I remember being in isolation, and even though we're at biosafety level 3, we started out in the pandemic doing all of those autopsies for potential COVID in our additional isolation room, which is another buffer, another layer of protection. And I remember in the middle of one of my autopsies, my tech's respirator, the PAPR, which pumps air up into the hood, her PAPR turned off in the middle of the autopsy. And she looked at me and she said, what do I do? And I said, get out. We'll take your PAPR off and change. And so she was fine. We got her checked out. We called the proper folks who we needed to talk to and just assured her she was still fine. But there's that moment and you kind of feel like you're in the one of those movies like Outbreak, because you're in the full, what we call the bunny suits. You're in those full PPE from head to toe with a novel pandemic virus. So for a moment, it was kind of like being in that, you know, Outbreak movie for a second until you realize you're okay. Just don't let fear take over. Use your scientific rationale. You're fine.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be quite, especially with so much was unknown for so long about the virus. Right now, currently, the number of deaths related to COVID in the state is just over 4,300. Does that mean you all had to autopsy all of those?
No, most people who pass away, we found were passing away in the hospital.
So if they died in the hospital, that's not necessarily something that would go to the Office of the Medical Investigator.
Right, right. Mm. Those were not coming. We were available for consults if a family wanted that, but I can't recall a case where a family wanted an autopsy. Since the pandemic started, we've done about 1,080 COVID tests.
Given that you were already short-staffed, how did you and your staff handle this? I imagine at times you were pretty overwhelmed.
We were, and they just, I really just have to commend the staff and the faculty. They just get the job done. They really don't complain. We're all going in doing more cases than we should be doing, and they've just realized this is what needs to be done, and they're keeping our mission that we're actually helping families and we're actually serving the living by doing this, and they just got the work done, and it's really a remarkable group of folks that we have here. The OMI faculty are currently, with the exception of Dr. Zumwalt, who's our 0.25 working retiree, we're all women forensic pathologists. Most of us have young kids, and we're working on cases until sometimes 11:30 at night, just trying to clear those cases out, because we realize that getting the death certificate issued is a huge deal for the families. It really impacts them financially and emotionally if it's late. It still takes us a couple months, for most of us about 3 months, to get that done. And we're just putting in the extra hours and getting it done. So it's really a remarkable group of folks here.
You're all women. How unusual is that?
It seems to be trending that way. And I don't think there's ever been a time in OMI's history where we've all been women. And so one of our residents actually commented he wants to go into forensics, and he wants to do his forensics fellowship at OMI. And he actually wants to stay on at OMI when he's done. And probably the best compliment that I could have gotten from him was that this office is run by amazing women. And historically, the forensics has been dominated by men. He said, I want to come here because it's a well-known office with a very good reputation, and it's run exclusively by women right now. And so that was actually a huge compliment.
Dr. Heather Jarrell, New Mexico Chief Medical Examiner. The OMI was created by the state legislature in 1972 to replace all the county coroners with a statewide medical examiner system. The staff investigate all reportable deaths to determine their cause and provide families with death certification. The office is a program within the Department of Pathology at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine. Well, we have some more environmental news now you may have been hearing about. I've read a number of commentaries on this, actually, at krwg.org. If New Mexico opts into advanced clean car standards, it will join Colorado, Nevada, and 15 other states. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown brings us up to date.
2 years ago, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham signed an executive order committing New Mexico to essential climate change goals. The order included a requirement that auto manufacturers deliver more electric vehicles to the state. But the timeline for a necessary rulemaking process to adopt advanced clean car standards has come and gone twice and been postponed a third time. Tammy Feibelkorn with the Southwest Energy Efficiency Project says cleaner cars are crucial to address climate change.
We have these goals of reducing our greenhouse gases and meeting our climate goals that are in the executive order that the governor signed. But until we can get some electric vehicles sold here, we're not going to meet the transportation limit.
Southwest Energy Efficiency is among a coalition of groups that filed a formal petition asking the state to adopt advanced clean car standards by year's end, a deadline state officials have said can't be met. New Mexico has installed more than 100 electric vehicle charging stations in various locations, but only about 1,200 plug-in electric vehicles are currently on the roads. Feiblkorn says the adoption of rules to govern advanced clean car standards is fairly straightforward because they must be identical to those of other states. She says New Mexico may be unable to implement standards until 2026 if it misses this year's December timeline.
Because of the way the standards are written, you have to wait 2 model years. And so if we can get it in this year, then that lets us implement a whole year sooner.
When it comes to purchasing an EV, the Consumer Choice Center ranks New Mexico and 16 other states in the barely accessible category, a notch above 9 other states where they are totally inaccessible, either because direct-to-consumer sales are banned or extra registration fees are exorbitant. Nationwide, electric vehicles represent less than 1% of all vehicles on the road. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
The StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative visited Las Cruces in March of last year. We featured all of the local veterans who came in to tell their stories. One, a Marine Corps veteran named Carol Gaines, came in twice to focus on the service of other veterans. KC Counts caught up with Captain Gaines to learn a little bit more about her life and time in the Marine Corps.
I grew up in a small town in northern Wisconsin, right on Lake Superior. My mother was a single parent. I don't have any brothers or sisters, so I always lived in an adult household with grandparents who grandpa spoke probably 5 or 6 languages. And after high school, a number of friends joined, no women that I knew of, but a lot of the high school kids then joined the military, and I thought, how come not women? So that just kind of sat with me, and then when by profession, I'm a high school English teacher, and I thought, I didn't really want to grade papers. I didn't want to decorate the classroom. I didn't, at that time, if any dealings with parents, the student was in trouble, not now so much. But I thought, I picked up a flyer from the Marines, and I thought, I can do that, and I can do that, and I know that. So I talked to my mom. By then, I was 19 or 20, and met the recruiter, and I went to officer training. At that time, it was called PLC, Platoon Leaders Class, which is like an ROTC. And it was a really big deal to go from small-town Wisconsin to Washington, D.C.
Before we hear about your training there, I was just curious, did you consider any of the other branches?
I did not. Once I picked up the Marines, I thought, they're special. That's what I want to be. Training for a Marine is always tough. But I am a determined woman.
So what was the next transition for you?
My first job was teaching, although I didn't think I wanted to do that. So I did that for about a year.
How long did you serve in the Marine Corps?
Well, I went in September of 1958. I was in Quantico for about a year and a half, got transferred to Washington, D.C., and I left the Marine Corps in February of 1960.
Did you ever go back to teaching?
Yes, I did. When we got here, I did a minor in library, and I worked at a Catholic school for 20 years as librarian.
And to this day, though, you're very committed to the Marine Corps and the military in general.
When we moved to Las Cruces, we had 2 little children at the time. Rob was born while we were in Portales. But we had a family to raise. Bob was busy working, so I was a stay-at-home mom. But then I always wanted to help women veterans, and I realized, especially the World War II women, said, well, I didn't really do anything, but some of them were of an age. They needed medical help. They needed with prescriptions. They needed how can I buy a house, what to do. So that was something that I started within 5 years of living here. And so it used to be kind of a social group. We met for lunch, and if somebody needed help, they would ask me, and I would help them with that. I thought, after this, we really need to get organized. And so that's how I got, let's get organized, and there were a group of us who got together. I wanted to build we had Veterans Park here by that time. I wanted to have something to honor those World War II women. So getting organized as a 501c3, we became United Military Women of the Southwest. We went to Santa Fe to see if we could get some money, and yes, we did. And that was my dream, to build the Women Veteran Monument at Veterans Park.
Tell me about your service in the Honor Guard.
It is a special group you volunteer for, buy your own uniforms, to do the final military honors for any veteran. We do the folding of the flag, presentation to the family. We do the final rifle volleys and the playing of taps.
It's quite an emotional time every time I go, and I've been doing this for almost 10 years now.
And at one point, you were in that position, receiving that flag.
Yes, I was. My husband has died. It's been now 6 years. And that was one of the hardest things that I've had to do, is to be the receiver of the flag. And as it turns out, the officer who was there is from Las Cruces. He went to Las Cruces High School, and he was a student of Marine Gaines, Bob mm-hmm. Gaines. And that Marine is now a Brigadier General. But when he was here to be the receiver of that flag, we could not look one another in the eye, because we both would have had a more emotional moment than we did. Bob is buried at Fort Bliss, and as Marines are shooters, he's buried in an ammo box. And while we were standing there, when after they bury, you're allowed then to go back, I said to my daughter and our son standing next to me, I want to be buried next to my Marine husband. Mm-hmm. And the woman from the cemetery heard me and said, if you get me your discharge certificate within 24 hours, I will save that gravesite for you. So now, when I go down, Bob is buried there, and there's an empty place next to him, which will be my place. I guess I'll close with, I'm Carol Gaines. I am a Marine. Semper Fidelis, always faithful. Hoorah.
To hear this segment, the full interview with Marine Corps veteran Captain Carol Gaines, and other StoryCorps interviews, go to the StoryCorps page. That's in the radio section at krwg.org. And a big thank you to KC Counts for putting this project together. What an amazing journey it has been over the last number of months. Thank you, KC. Funding for this segment and others provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents, accepting admission in their 3 sanitized homes. More at 575-525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. Finally this week, tomorrow morning at 11, KRWG-TV airs a 1-hour documentary about the history and future of vaccinations in the United States. Vaccination from the misinformation virus will help parents and community leaders understand how important and safe vaccines are, how crucial they are to community health, and how they save millions of lives every year. Epidemiologist Dr. John Grabenstein of the Immunization Action Coalition is featured in the program.
How do I get you, or anybody, willing to roll up your sleeve and take that injection? And the how do I convince you that it's worth it? It's worth it because you get years and years and years of protection against some pretty nasty viruses and bacteria, and that's why it's worth it.
The broadcast of the documentary coincides with a decline in COVID-19 vaccinations, but production of the documentary began years ago as states, including Texas, began to see outbreaks of diseases that have been largely eliminated due to vaccines. All 50 states currently require vaccines for measles, mumps, and other diseases for school attendance, though exemptions are made on religious and medical grounds. Nearly 600 colleges and universities will require students and some faculty and staff to have COVID-19 vaccinations before returning to campus in the fall. But that's not the case for schools in New Mexico, including NMSU and UNM. Vaccination from the misinformation virus airs tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for joining us on KRWG News this week. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.